The Institute on Religious Life has brought you a series of taped lectures by one of today's leading theologians, Father John A. Hardin, S.J. Some of these taped lectures have proved difficult to understand because of surface or tape noise, or because of some sort of outside interference. The problem of hearing and understanding is further accentuated when some of the users attempted to play the tapes on loudspeaker systems for the benefit of their communities. For this reason, it has become necessary to retape certain of these lectures to assure clarity of voice and content. In such cases, we have had to resort to a substitute voice, but we assure you that the words spoken and the ideas presented are those of Father John A. Hardin, with nothing added and nothing subtracted. The substitute voice is that of one Robert Warnock. Now, the current lecture is on the subject, how to recognize a true religious vocation. Given the premises about what religious life is, we know that those under our care can never be too clear, and not just the young novices or postulants, but religious all their lives. In fact, sometimes I'm afraid the younger ones may be clearer than some of the veterans. Given, however, the premises of what religious life is, there is great wisdom in recognizing who has or who does not have a true religious vocation. Only in eternity will we know why what happened did. You don't lose 55,000 religious women in less than 15 years. You don't drop religious vocations to religious life by 90% in 50 years without a reason. One reason, I firmly believe, is that we have made many mistakes in taking people in who did not have a true religious vocation. I'm assuming all kinds of other factors, and there are 1,000. But then it is so important to recognize a true, and I stress the word true, religious vocation. First, in countries like the United States, with our emphasis on freedom, we have allowed the gospel meaning of a vocation to become confused. We assumed that religious vocations are something you must first sell to people, convince them that they should become religious, advertise and publicize, and then wait, and hope that people will buy the product. General Motors sells cars. Procter & Gamble, soap. And we presumably are selling what we call religious life. And we've had so many customers, and we're happy, because in the $50 billion industry, and that's the total cost of advertising in a given year in the United States, we've assumed maybe that is what a vocation is. It's something you sell. No. A vocation is something you find. The gospel picture of Christ calling the 12 couldn't be clearer. Christ, being God, knew who had and who didn't have the grace. That's easy. He gave it. Now look, we are not Christ, so we don't have the divine insight that the divine master had. So, speaking reverently, Christ would not need this lecture on how to recognize a true vocation. But then because he recognized, he picked those he knew had a vocation. We know that at least from one episode in the Gospel that there were more than just the 12 who had a vocation. First then, after recognition, he selected. Secondly, he invited, which means he requested. But then thirdly, which seems like a contradiction to being invited, he ordered. In case you haven't been told, the Greek of the New Testament, every time that Christ said, "Come, follow me," it is imperative. It is in the imperative mood. Now, the "come" gives it the invitation, but the "follow me" is imperative. To what then did Christ call the apostles to follow? Me. In other words, to become like me, to imitate me, to grow in holiness like me, to endure what you see me enduring. One of the most incredible statements of Jesus, remember before his passion, when Christ predicted how he would have to suffer and die, and Peter said, "Lord, not so." What did Christ call Peter? He called him Satan. Following Christ without the cross is blasphemy. To follow me, to finally cooperate with me in the salvation of souls, that formula hasn't changed. There are a lot of books being written trying to change it, but it hasn't changed. All right, so much for the introduction. How to recognize? Like the Savior, we too are to do three things: select, invite, and tell the people to follow Christ. But not being Christ, we do not have the ready knowledge of who has the grace. Hence the value of reflecting on some norm for discovering who has, or, I repeat, who does not have a true religious vocation. I would summarize these norms or reduce them mainly to three: a strong faith, a disposition to prayer, and a readiness to sacrifice. There are, as you know, many other norms that we could talk about, but I believe these three underlie all the others. First, faith. This means a believing mind. We believe with the mind. We don't believe with the emotions or the feelings or even the will, but with the mind. And this implies a humble mind. I know I've dealt with so many minds, and for a teacher, that is almost a profession in itself. There is no necessary connection between the good mind and the humble mind. People with extraordinary intelligence may not have a humble mind. People with good intelligence can have a very humble mind. And people with very limited mental resources can be very proud. This implies, therefore, a humble mind that is ready to believe whatever God has revealed. Now, you know, and I know, that the faith which people have may be a very undeveloped faith, and that's an understatement. It can be a very confused faith, it may not always be an accurate faith. They may be sure of 1, 2, 3. There is one God, two natures in Christ, and three persons in the Trinity. But beyond that, they may be quite uncultivated in their faith. And again, don't make the mistake of judging their lack of accuracy or soundness or knowledge with having or not having a strong faith, which is, or which means, the mental disposition to believe. Second, prayer. This means that a person has a prayerful spirit that does not have to force itself to communicate with God. The kind of person that has a religious vocation wants to pray. It doesn't necessarily mean, as we all know so well know, that that kind of person finds prayer easy. Again, it may be a very undeveloped kind of prayer, or it may always be a neglected response to pray. But when God gives a religious vocation, He keeps after the person. Talk to me. Listen to me. Say something. And sometimes the very effort to run away from God may be the surest sign of having a vocation. Again, don't mistake the lack of response to the vocation as the lack of vocation. There may be a very strange approach to prayer, and some of the bizarre antics, especially in the young, perpetuates their desire to communicate with God. You want to close your eyes and ears. Is that prayer? It may take time, it may take years, to develop and mature this spirit of prayer. But the gift of prayer is one of the indispensable signs of a true religious vocation. Those who have a religious life have then the grace of prayer, which must be taught, corrected, matured, and trained. Who doubts it? But the gift is there. I learned this, at least minimally, it dawned on me when I was in high school. I still remember. Sister Leocrezia was her name, and she had this pleasant habit whenever she talked to us, especially when the subject was something more serious, she would rub her hands. John, she asked me, how much do you pray? Well, I had to admit, not too much. But then she asked other questions, and she pulled out of me, and this is in high school, 7 or 8 years before I finally gave up and said, Lord, you win. I admitted that I liked to pray, although I liked other things much more. The secret, then, is to discover in the person, though sometimes overladen with all kinds of debris, the gift of prayer. And third, sacrifice. This means the capacity to surrender oneself to God. And as with other things, there are all kinds of pseudo-counterparts. It's not the same as spontaneous generosity or kindness or an affectionate nature. Did you know that people who are not naturally affectionate can have great potential for sacrifice? Being nice to people, affability, can be selfish. Did you know also that they can use other people and smile in the process, to camouflage what's going on. This capacity for sacrifice is in the order of grace and therefore is above the power of nature. A person with a genuine religious vocation has a mysterious willingness to give up self, to surrender self, give of self for the love of God according to his known will. That's why there are so many surprises among vocations. Again, as with faith and prayer, the grace of sacrifice may be resisted by the person. Indeed, it may be only weakly responded to. And how? A person may be actually irritated with having this mysterious urge to give oneself up to God. I cannot tell you how many people have told me, "Lord, I wish I didn't have this, whatever it is. It's crazy. It doesn't make sense." I tell them, "It's not supposed to. That's what grace is. You don't understand grace. You identify it, and then you respond." In a true religious vocation, the gift is always there. And again, as with faith and prayer, and this is what formation is all about, it has to be worked on, refined, matured. Yet all the while, there is a gift already possessed, a talent for self-surrender, and a desire to sacrifice. Otherwise, there is no religious vocation. At this point, one of the brothers in the class asked the following question. Vocation is a grace. Grace is invisible. Now, we can only see the effects of grace. And now, then, with these three criteria you give us, you tell us they can't be resisted. So, apparently, I can't even see the effects of grace. And if you can't see the effects of grace, how can you tell that they have a vocation? And Father Hayden's reply, "Well, I like the adverb, apparently. But let me assure you, if you try hard enough, you can discern. Now, you will make mistakes. Religious life has made enough mistakes, but it will be in spite of ourselves and not because we have not taken proper means. There is such a thing as a person honestly trying. First of all, there should be some norms and standards in formation. Otherwise, then, you can't tell. Have certain expectations that those in formation should live up to. These expectations should not be exotic, not extravagant, but reasonable. And that is, if they are trying, they will be able to fulfill. But that they won't be able to fulfill if they don't have the grace. Take, for example, living with others in community life. Never forget, there are four essentials to the religious life. Not just poverty, not chastity and obedience only. It is community life. There are four essentials. Four. If you drop one of these essentials, you have a secular institute. And that's the church's own analysis. This living, then, in community life is a good index as to whether the person has the grace. The chastity may be more subtle. The obedience, there are ways of testing that, and even the poverty. but say prayer. Opportunities for prayer where the person is supposed to respond, and if they do, that doesn't necessarily mean that the person has the vocation, but then the lack of response may be one good reason for their not praying the way they should, not living in community as amicably as they should, and may also be that they just don't have the grace. So I would say, does the person show willingness to live up to certain reasonable norms? You know, getting along with people is not the same as loving people. This was followed by a question from one of the nuns asking about the importance of good physical health. And Father Hardin's reply: the physical health of the candidate, of course, depends on the nature of the work of the Institute. A person may have the physical health to be a Franciscan Sister of the Sacred Heart, but not a Carmelite, which requires fasting and all sorts of austerity. And again, regarding mental health, here too, if a person does not have basic judgment, if they lack the kind of mental balance that is required for ordinary living, there is no vocation to the religious life. But there are strains and strains on one's mental health, just as there are strains and strains on one's physical health. Now, it took me more than 5 years to come to the meaning of this lesson, 5 years as a chaplain of a mental institute. Most of the people in mental institutions are casualties of emotional pressure which they couldn't take, a certain kinds of employment that was just maddening, certain cities like New York City. You have to have an extraordinary strong mind to keep from being psychotic in New York. And so with certain kinds of apostolates in certain communities, the kind of people that are already in the community that might require almost heroic sanctity for a person to maintain their full mental health and get along in the community. Some people are hard to get along with, and there is wisdom in knowing what kind of religious, the one you are forming, will be to live with. But per se, basic health is required. Enough health to be able to live up to whatever minimal requirements the institute or community has, and such mental health to be able to withstand the ordinary strains of especially community living.
Turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.